Hi, you're listening to the Heritage Radio Network, and this is a Heritage Radio Network special, Out to Pasture, Meeting the Demand for Local Meat in New York City and Beyond. I'm your host, Nelson Harvey. And there's a lot of hype out there about local meat everywhere you look these days, a lot of talk about heritage pigs and grass-fed beef. But in this series, we're going to go beyond the hype and find out what farmers, slaughterhouse workers, butchers, and others are actually facing as they try to meet the growing demand for local meat in New York City. We're presenting the special in three parts. The theme of today's show is the farm, and we'll continue next week with the slaughterhouse. And we'll wrap things up with the butcher shop 2 weeks from now. For anyone who eats meat and for anyone who likes their meat to be as clean and come from as close as possible, it's some juicy listening. So stay tuned. All right, picture this. It's 1880 and you're on the corner of 24th Street and Lexington Avenue. Except it's not 24th Street and Lexington as we know it today. It's Manhattan's Central Stockyard, the place where live cattle arrive after being driven in from upstate New York or New Jersey, or rolled in on trains from western cities like Chicago. You can see the dust rising from the rows of cattle pens. You can see the animals milling about. And you watch as the cattle buyers and the butchers walk from one animal to the next, feeling their haunches, appraising them for purchase. What you're watching is the way that New York City used to get its meat. Farmers, then later trains, brought live animals to town, where butchers would buy them, slaughter them on the spot or nearby, and sell them within a day or so before the meat went bad. At that point, New York was the center of beef slaughter on the East Coast and a major center for the slaughter of other animals. But as you're standing on the corner of 24th and Lexington, watching all this play out, you know something that no one else does. And that is that within a year, a man named Gustavus Swift will do something that will change this system forever. He'll start slaughtering animals in Chicago, not New York, almost 800 miles closer to the western ranches where cities of the East are starting to turn for their meat. He'll ship the carcasses east in refrigerated train cars, and by doing this, Swift will save a lot of money. Because while his competitors are still putting whole live animals on trains to the east, he'll only be shipping the parts of the animal that people will eventually eat. Now, because of this, the price of beef will fall by 20% within 10 years, a drop that will eventually make beef America's most popular meat. But there's a dark side, of course, for New York City's meat industry. New York slaughterhouses will start to close. The network of stockyards where the railroads loaded and unloaded live animals for the journey east will fall by the wayside, since you don't need a stockyard for animals that have already been slaughtered. Wholesale butchers in New York will be undercut by Swift's low prices and forced to join him or get out of the game, and Chicago will replace New York as the city of meat. In 1906, of course, Upton Sinclair will publish his scandalous book, The Jungle, detailing a whole litany of abuses and poor conditions in the slaughterhouses of Swift and his competitors. So why am I telling you this? Well, as it turns out, that man, Gustavus Swift, whose actions transformed the way that New York got its meat, was my great-great-great-grandfather. And it was through his story that I got interested in finding out where New York's meat comes from. So let's leave the 1800s and fast forward about 129 years to today. Eating locally is huge. For our ancestors, it was a matter of survival, but today it's a fashion statement and a political statement. Distrust in the industrial food system that my ancestor helped to jumpstart hasn't been this high since the years after The Jungle came out. And people don't just want local peaches and local Brussels sprouts. They want local meat. In New York, restaurants like Per Se, Casamono, Marlowe & Sons, and others are sourcing whole animals and doing the butchering themselves rather than settling for the boxed, pre-cut meat that the large meat packers provide. Butchers are now sexy. An article in the New York Times in July of this year documented the rock star appeal that many butchers have acquired thanks to their macho associations with danger, blood, and knives. And right now, anyone in the industry will tell you that demand for local meat in New York City exceeds supply. And it's a demand that farmers, distributors, butchers, and others are racing to meet. But there's a guy, his name's Peter Mark Tullio, and he teaches urban studies at Columbia. He's estimated that more than 650,000 tons of meat are flowing into New York City every year. And although no one's measured it exactly, a trip to most supermarkets will show you that locally produced meat still represents a tiny trickle of the total meat we eat compared to what's coming in from large meatpacking plants around the country. So, could New York or even the whole Northeast ever be a center of meat production again? Will local pasture-raised meats ever satisfy anything more than a fraction of New York's endless appetite for meat? Should they? These are the questions we're going to tackle in this series, and we'll start right where our meat starts with episode one, The Farm.
Listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today's program was brought to you by Edwards of Surrey, Virginia. www.edwardsvaham.com.
All right. I hate to keep jerking you backwards and forwards through time, but let's take another trip. This time, let's go back a little further. It's a Sunday afternoon in the fall of 1770. It's Westchester County on the road into New York, and of course, there's a traffic jam. Only, it isn't cars that are backed up, it's animals. Cows, sheep, pigs, chickens, you name it. And much like the cars that'll follow them in a couple hundred years, they're making quite a racket, mooing, chewing, baaing, snorting, as drovers from farms throughout Westchester herd them slowly toward the city. Now back then, this traffic jam was nothing less than New York City's meat supply in motion. Back then, the city's population was so small that meat from Westchester County could satisfy most of its carnivorous appetite. Of course, this didn't last long. As the city grew, its agricultural footprint extended further upstate into Connecticut, Pennsylvania, and then even Ohio. And today, it's doubtful that even the entire Northeast could produce enough pasture-raised meat to supply what New York consumes. But that's not to say that the Northeast couldn't produce a whole lot more. For more than a century, of course, the trend hasn't been to produce more locally, it's been to produce less. And that's something that the media blitz over sexy butchers and grass-fed steaks has failed to capture. According to that Columbia professor I mentioned, Peter Mark Tullio, who wrote a paper on the environmental impact of meat consumption in New York, the amount of farmland in the tri-state area, New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, dropped by more than 18% from 1974 to 2002. And the amount of pasture land acreage in the tri-state area, that dropped by 70% from 1945 to 2002. So what happened to local agriculture around New York City? Why aren't more people farming? Who is farming? And what are the prospects for putting some of New York State's vacant land back to work for us producing meat? We got two excellent guests to help us answer these questions. First, we'll talk to Judith LaBelle, a longtime environmental attorney and the president of the Glenwood Center, a working farm outside of Cold Spring, New York. Next, we'll bring on Dan Welch, an educator with the Cornell University Cooperative Extension up in Cayuga County, New York, to tell us about all the vacant pasture land in New York State and what we might do with it. This is the Heritage Radio Network. A special titled Out to Pasture, a hard look at local meat in New York City and beyond. I'm your host, Nelson Harvey. And we're back with Judith LaBelle, a longtime environmental attorney and the president of the Glenwood Center, a working farm outside of Cold Spring, New York, and the place where Judith and her colleagues work to find ways to save farming in the Northeast. Judith LaBelle, welcome to the Heritage Radio Network.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for being with us. So I want to start by talking about some of these figures that I mentioned in my introduction, like the fact that total farmland in the tri-state area decreased by more than 18% from 1974 to 2002. Your focus is in the Hudson Valley primarily, so within that context, can you tell us about the forces in play here? What's been happening to all of this farmland and why?
Well, they're both regional and national forces. On the regional level, we've had very strong development pressure, particularly for second homes, especially after 9-1-1, and I'm sorry, 9-11. And there are high costs of doing business near the city, so it's a very difficult place to be a farmer. At the same time, there are national forces, the push to get bigger, get out, and the growth of agribusiness and industrial farming and desire for cheap food, which makes it hard for smaller farmers to compete. And the infrastructure that they rely on for processing and marketing has really been frayed, so it makes it hard for them to get to market and to get the price that reflects the quality that they are producing. But I will say that more recently there's been a counter trend, which is a change in the type of farming and more small farms reflecting the growth of consumer demand and direct sales. And there's also a growing interest in bringing land back into production.
And sort of given the declines that I talked about, but also in light of this new kind of resurgence of farming, can you give us a sense of who is farming now? Is there, can you say anything, make any generalizations about the type of farms that are predominant in the Hudson Valley and the type of farmers that are working the land?
Well, we are really fortunate here because we have a tremendous mix of types of production and sizes of farms and types of farmers. We have everything from family farmers who've been on the land here for generations and new farmers who are focusing on new kinds of specialty crops for the New York City market. But overall, we have nearly 1,000 square miles of farmland left in the valley, which is tremendous when you consider that we do have this development pressure and we're located between New York City and Albany. So it's a challenging location, and yet we have about the same percentage of our land in farmland here as there is in the state overall.
Right. Now, I wanted to get back to talking about meat production specifically. You wrote a paper in 2006 called Slaughterhouses and Sprawl about agriculture in the Hudson Valley. And you said, quote, "In today's market, a farmer producing niche vegetables on a few acres may have a higher net income than a beef or dairy producer on a few hundred." With reference specifically to beef producers, can you explain why this would be true?
Well, there are, again, a mix of factors. There's a growing market for the direct sale of specialty vegetables to restaurants or CSAs, and it gives farmers an opportunity to get a higher percentage of the consumer dollar by selling direct, and from consumers who are willing to pay for the freshness and quality that they can get. And if you're doing a specialty vegetable or fruit production, you can produce a great deal on a small amount of land, so your land costs can be quite low. In contrast to livestock producers who have high land costs, and many have trouble reaching the strong and growing consumer market that's out there, people who do want regional pastured meat, because they have trouble getting to market. They have trouble getting their meat processed. So it can be very economically inefficient for them, and that really impacts their bottom line. So their net, at the end of the day, may be relatively low.
And there's an issue, too, having to do with slaughterhouses, which I know is something that you and the Glenwood Center has looked at a lot. There's a sort of a catch-22, isn't there, with the relationship between the number of slaughterhouses in the Hudson Valley and the number of people farming, since if you're a farmer, you want to be sure that there's slaughterhouse capacity before you go into it, and if there's low slaughterhouse capacity, you probably wouldn't. And then if you're a slaughterhouse, you want to be sure that there are farmers, and if there aren't many people farming who are going to give you regular business, you're probably not going to open up that slaughterhouse. I wonder if you could sort of address that a little bit and proposed remedies that you might see there.
Well, it really is a catch-22, you're right. And certainly from the farmer's perspective, it doesn't make sense to raise livestock if you're not confident you can get it to market and get a good price. And at the moment, there are only four USDA slaughterhouses in the Hudson Valley, and they're basically operating at capacity. So farmers often have to schedule a year in advance and then use that slot regardless of whether or not it's the optimal time for that animal. And they have to travel long distances, and it's very inefficient regarding the cost and the time to the farmer. And quality is sometimes a problem. The farmer can invest years in developing genetics for their animals and spend, a year to 18 months caring for the animals and yet lose that value in a minute if the animal isn't handled well at the end, and certainly if the meat isn't butchered well. Tom Milan, the butcher at Marlowe & Daughters, says the first question he asks the farmer who wants to sell to him is, do you have a kill slot? Because that is really the great barrier. But as you've suggested on the other side, it's a very low-margin business, and so it's not the most attractive business for people to go into. And unless there's a strong demand that you're certain of, you're certainly not going to go into this business and make that investment. And as we looked at the situation overall, it seemed that in an area like this where there are scattered smaller farms, one effective answer could be a mobile facility so that you could have a facility that would travel to docking sites around the region and be able to be responsive to the demand that exists and encourage it to grow, because as people find that they can get more efficient processing, many of them have told us that they would substantially increase, maybe even double the production that they have. So as that happens, you could just change the way you're servicing it.
And so you're literally talking about a mobile slaughterhouse, a slaughterhouse on wheels. What does this look like?
It looks like a 53-foot tractor trailer. And so if it's traveling down the road, you would have no idea of what it was. And then it has some other modular units, other smaller trailers that are used in conjunction with it to be configured as a very small, high-quality slaughter facility.
And so you can actually slaughter the animal in this and then also age it, age the beef, age the whatever it is in a separate compartment?
Yes. Yes. So it would go from the processing up through the meat in quarters, which would be chilled and have their initial aging until they're picked up to be taken for further aging or to a butcher shop that would process it, or some farmers might take it and have the butchering done themselves. So it could be very flexible that way.
And Glenwood is currently trying to develop one of these.
Yes, indeed. We've been, as I said, working with the task force for about a year now, and we have a very clear sense of how we're going to proceed, and we look forward to having some major developments later this year, early next.
Excellent, excellent. Well, Judith LaBelle, thank you very much for being with us. Appreciate it, and hope to see the results of your work soon.
Thanks very much.
You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. We'll be back with more from Dan Welch, head of Cornell's Grasslands Utilization Team, to tell us about all of New York's vacant land and what we can do with it.
You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today's program was brought to you by Edwards of Surrey, Virginia. www.edwardsvaham.com.
Welcome back to the Heritage Radio Network. You're listening to a Heritage Radio Network special we're calling Out to Pasture, meeting the demand for local meat in New York City and beyond. And we're back with Dan Welch. Dan is an educator with the Cornell University Cooperative Extension up in Cayuga County, New York, and he's a member of something called the Grasslands Utilization Work Team associated with Cornell, and he's going to tell us about all the vacant pasture land in New York State and what we might do with it. Dan Welch, welcome to the Heritage Radio Network.
Oh, thank you, Nelson. Good to be with you this evening.
Pleasure to have you. So, you are a member, as I mentioned, of this Grasslands Utilization Work Team, which is associated with Cornell's Small Farms Program. Just briefly, can you tell us, why was that group formed and what is its function?
One of the hallmarks of the Small Farms Program has been listening directly to farmers and trying to address some of their concerns. And it was brought forward to the program a couple years ago that there was all this vacant pasture land available in New York that could be utilized for raising local meats and milk. And there were a lot of issues surrounding that that made it difficult for farmers to access that land.
And if I understand it correctly, your team has identified over 3 million acres of vacant pasture land in New York State alone. So this raises obviously a big question, which is, how is this land being classified? What's being done with this land right now?
Well, the primary use, about a little over 2 million acres of that land, is being used as residential properties, either as a primary residence with a large amount of land, or as second homes for people from the tri-state area or Albany or Buffalo, some of the bigger cities that move out or have a place to go to on the weekends that are in a little more of a rural setting.
Sure. Which of these categories, there's also abandoned agricultural land out there, isn't there?
Yeah, about 700,000 acres of this land is abandoned farmland from farms that have gone out of business primarily in the last 30 years or so, but before that, even since World War II, as farms have consolidated and they've left some of the marginal land to concentrate their operations on the better soils.
And it would seem that in terms of getting some of this land back into production, that's probably the stuff that has the most potential, right, in terms of getting people back on that land. The abandoned farmland's probably set up pretty well. As
opposed to... the abandoned farmland has the advantage of there's probably still some infrastructure that, even though it certainly will need some repair, you don't have to start from scratch. There may be an old barn that just needs some renovation, or fencing might be there where the fence posts are, but you just have to string up new wires to keep the animals in.
So we've got 3 million acres of land, some of it vacant private land, some of it abandoned agricultural land, and some of it in other categories. The second question that occurred to me when I read that, of course, was what's keeping farmers from farming that land? So I wonder, could you talk about some of the obstacles that people are facing as they look at trying to put that land back into production? And could you also mention some of the solutions that your team has come up with?
Okay. One of the issues with that land is there's not always a clearly identified owner that a farmer could talk to about buying it. Some of the abandoned agricultural land may have been taken out of farming in the 60s, and for whatever reason, the family has kept on that land or kept title to that land, but they no longer live in that community. So a farmer can't go and say, hey, I'd like to buy that land to raise beef cattle on.
So they're absentee owners, effectively.
Right. Yeah. And with the residential land, there's the issue of, can we make agricultural operations on those land compatible with what the residential owners want? Like, if they still want snowmobile trails or hunting or something like that, can we work together so that it's a win-win for the landowner and the farmer?
Sure, sure.
And some of that land, I imagine, is pretty broken up into, as you mentioned, kind of not necessarily contiguous parcels.
Yeah, it's, you know, some of that land, the way, you know, even though almost all of it was probably at one time farmland, some of it might have grown up into forest at this point, some of it might still be open, so it's a little more difficult to transition that back into productive pasture land.
Sure, sure. Now, I wanted to close just briefly by asking you, you know, it seems like obviously there's a lot of potential for a lot more pasture-raised meat to be produced in New York State, but are there other challenges that you can think of that need to be tackled before this type of farming can become much more common around here?
Yeah, one of the issues is the, I guess, the bottleneck between all having all this land that could be available for production and then the markets that we have, especially in the city, but also upstate New York is, you know, fairly close to Boston, Washington, D.C. So there's those markets there, and farmers are having trouble accessing those markets. A lot of farmers are not necessarily marketers, and they don't want to be marketers. They just want to raise animals. So there isn't an effective way for a farmer, let's say in the North Country, to just raise his animals and have that animal be sold and processed and then delivered to the city.
So there needs to be maybe some kind of a middleman or some kind of somebody to aggregate all these animals from all these small farms and bring them to market.
Yes. Yeah, that would be one solution. And they have a lot of that capacity out in the West and the Midwest where the agricultural infrastructure is more set up to handle livestock, but that hasn't been our traditional role in New York. We're more of a dairy state. We're set up to do that. So the livestock part of it, you know, can there's some areas that we can work on so that hopefully we can increase the amount of local meats that are being sold to consumers in New York.
Sure, sure. We've been talking with Dan Welch, educator with the Cornell University Cooperative Extension up in Cayuga County, New York, and a member of the Cornell Grasslands Utilization Work Team. Dan Welch, thank you very much for being with us today. Appreciate it.
Okay, thank you. Have a good evening.
You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. So, in the last half hour, we've talked to two people on the front lines of the effort to revitalize New York's local meat industry. And they're just two of a whole army of people getting into this field, from activists to farmers and butchers. As we've seen, they face some serious challenges, from a shortage of affordable farmland to a lack of small slaughterhouses that farmers can trust. We're going to explore that slaughterhouse issue more deeply in our next episode a week from now. And then we'll close out the series with the show focusing on the butcher shop. You've been listening to a Heritage Radio Network special we're calling Out to Pasture, Meeting the Demand for Local Meat in New York City and Beyond. I'm your host, Nelson Harvey. Thanks again. This is the Heritage Radio Network.